body.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Lisa Francesca Nand, and you're listening to the Big Travel Podcast, exploring life stories through travel. On this episode, Hannah Martin, makeup artist to the stars, YouTube and Instagram star, tells us about traveling on the pro team with Bobby Brown, negotiating cultural differences in China, and also opens up about her struggles to become a mum, including bravely having to inject IVF meds in the middle of New York Fashion Week. I'm so pleased to have Hannah Martin on the Big Travel Podcast.
If I'm the manager of Pro and Artistry for Bobby Brown UK and Ireland. So it's great because I'm still doing makeup myself. I manage a team of fab makeup artists, and then I'm kind of linked in with senior management also. So kind of sitting on roundtable meetings discussing goodness knows what. It's a very varied job, a very busy job, but I love it.
You're actually very, very well known in your field. And whereas some of us, like me, have been quietly building this sort of conventional media career, maybe not very successfully at times.
Stop it.
For many years, online, on Instagram and YouTube, you're massive and very, very famous. I mean, you could literally post a picture of you brushing your teeth in the morning and within half an hour, you'd get 2,000 people liking it.
Well, that's kind of you to say. And I think what I've done over the last couple of years is carve out a really lovely, really loyal fan base isn't the right word, but a loyal following. But if you look at kind of the world of Instagram and the world of YouTube, I'm actually really small fry. But actually, it's good because what I have in my favour is, as I say, loyal followers, really high engagement, which is great. So I don't have loads of followers on either platform that aren't kind of into it.
You've got 33,000 subscribers on YouTube, I checked this morning.
Oh, sweet. Have I really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's gone up a bit.
I don't know what it is on Instagram, but it's a lot. But it's a whole new world.
Even for me, so I know I'm kind of classed as a millennial, but I'm very much the back end of that. I don't know how at school I kind of bypassed the IT-ness. So I've never actually really had a computer lesson. When Bear was born, I didn't have an Instagram account. I was married before I had a Facebook account. So unlike my peers who have grown up with social media, I haven't. So I definitely feel, amongst my colleagues at work even, that I'm very much like a novice in this sphere because we haven't grown up with the idea of posting everything on social media.
Well, you're doing very well with it now. And how have you built it up then? How have you built up such a big following?
I think through repetitive posting. So I think, and I read a blog post this week even about someone, I can't remember her name, a blogger in the States who was saying that to become big on these platforms, you just have to use them and use their functionality. So posting regularly, so Instagram kind of every day, making sure that your Instagram feed aesthetically has a style and it's kind of aesthetically pleasing. So if someone logs in for the first time, they can swipe very quickly and ascertain whether or not they like your feed. If your feed's too messy, then someone might look at it and then not want to buy in and press follow. And actually I have to thank the lovely Claire Alexander, who on Instagram is known as Jet Set Mama. She is the younger sister of one of my best friends, and a couple of years ago she said, you know, your account's good, but you need to post every day. You need some kind of synergy. Don't make it too fussy. So she gave me some hints and tips, and from then I kind of took it seriously, and yeah, it's going well.
Do you get recognised in the street? Are you known?
I'd love to be like, oh no. But sometimes, and it's really quite funny. So whether it's on Oxford Street, someone going, oh my God, Hannah! And I'm like, oh yes, do I know you? Are you one of our artists? Oh gosh, and I panic for a minute, and then someone just says, oh, I follow you, can I have a picture? Or I had a funny case at Paper Chase when I was just buying something, and they were like, have you got a Paper Chase card? And I was like, oh, I don't, but let's sign up for one, whatever. And she's like, oh, shut up, you were here yesterday, weren't you? No. She's like, you were, we had a chat, you were here yesterday. And then as soon as I wrote my name on this card, she went, I'm an idiot, I follow you on Instagram and YouTube. So yeah, it's funny.
You do some TV work as well.
Yeah, I've done some fun segments for Lorraine and This Morning and QVC, of course.
Have you managed to travel far and wide with your job?
Yes, so my job is mainly, the travel is mainly stateside, but I did have a wonderful nearly 3 weeks in China, which was mad for many reasons. So a couple of days on Hong Kong, which were just wonderful and exciting, but still quite comfortable. And then Kunming, which is a really beautiful part of China. But again, I was just in culture shock. So dealing with culture shock, trying to work, dealing with completely different makeup styles and aesthetics and the ideals of what's beautiful was really eye-opening, challenging, but I loved it.
What were you there for?
In Hong Kong, I was training some artists on like studio makeup. I then did a photo shoot with Harper's Bazaar Hong Kong. And then I did a full day's bridal work. So we did a big press launch. I did some interviews and some makeup and a shoot. And then in Kunming, a huge department store had this big stage. It was so funny. So essentially, for 4 or 5 days, I was on this main stage doing makeup demonstrations with one of my Chinese colleagues who didn't speak English, speaking in Chinese, and then I would speak a bit in English and do a demo, and then that we'd kind of go back and forth. But the thing that was hilarious is I didn't know what he was saying and he didn't know what I was saying, but through the power of makeup, we just made it work. And then in between all of that, I'd do kind of little interviews and aside makeups with PR people. And
what was the most culturally shocking aspect about working in China?
Two things. So the food, just so very different, and stepping outside of my comfort zone and not really knowing, but getting the sense that, and I know now with hindsight, that food and entertaining is very important, and certainly making sure a guest is satisfied is very, very, very important. So often, you know, so much food was ordered and I'd feel obliged to eat a lot, and often it was things that I would never normally eat. So I just, it's funny, I've got a reputation now with the team out there for being really game, because I, you name it, they brought it to me and I ate it. But then also just, I suppose, a real juxtaposition with being in, you know, a really beautiful town with great clean air and being in a really massive hotel and working in a big shopping centre, but then poverty all around you. The street right next to the hotel, you've got elderly people gambling on the streets, sanitation maybe in some areas of the city not being so great. I had a bit of an incident where I bought a round of Starbucks coffees for people, not realising just how expensive a Starbucks coffee was. So actually my gesture, which was meant to be really kind to some of the artists that we employed, was possibly a bit of a gross display of cash. But again, to me, in London, you go to a Starbucks. I go to Starbucks daily and it's totally fine. But out there, I don't want to get this wrong, but the price of one coffee was a significant amount to your average person.
When you accidentally offend someone, I think they forgive you. Because I hope they forgive you, because they must know.
Well, I hope so. Certainly a couple of times I asked for rice at supper. Now, anyone who knows me knows I'm a carb freak and I love my rice. But what I didn't know was that actually in China, that's quite rude. And you would only ask for rice if your hosts hadn't satisfied you with everything else they've prepared for you. I was kind of just completely oblivious. I just kind of wanted rice to mop up some of the, you know, deliciousness that I was eating. So again, I wish I'd had a Western colleague there who knew a bit more about the culture, just to make sure I didn't offend people. Yes, which surprised me. I do have an Australian colleague who worked out there and I assumed he'd be with me, but no, he wasn't.
You've been to New York Fashion Week.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Wonderfully crazy, wonderfully real, not quite as glamorous as I had imagined as a young aspiring makeup artist, but it's fantastic. Thinking back to the last season I did, we landed kind of late one evening. The next morning I was straight to a show to assist Mark Regan, our head of artistry, with a show. I left that show early to go and get Jenny Packham ready for her show. I left her to go to the Jenny Packham show and do the Jenny Packham show. And it's just busy, hectic, makeup everywhere, but a wonderful creative time that I, you know, was really special. I think what surprises me most is, as a young artist, you imagine the work backstage at Fashion Week, you know, is your very best work and you've got loads of time and space to get it great. But the truth is, it's often really rushed, really cramped. You're trying to create these great high fashion looks with really minimal time. Often there's a manicurist on nails, on, you know, hands, a manicurist on toes, two hair people. So, it, you know, it's really challenging, but great. And I think my first couple of seasons, I was terrified. And then thankfully, as I've grown into it, I've really enjoyed my last couple of seasons, which is great. So I feel confident now that I can say I really love Fashion Week, whereas in the early days I did it, but it wasn't where I excelled because I was kind of, I felt a weight of pressure and was always really nervous about it.
Was everyone very nice and accepting? Because sometimes you get the impression that something like New York Fashion Week would be full of Anna Wintour types that were a little bit icy and aloof maybe.
I think, yeah, I definitely think there can be some. So some stylists, for example, you know, you'll work really hard on a show and then the stylist of the show can dislike one thing about it and you suddenly have to change it all up. So that can be interesting.
And do you get to do stuff when you're there, or is it literally work, work, work?
No, we generally always do get to do some fun stuff. So whether it's with my UK colleagues, if it's going out for drinks in the evening, or with all of us going for great meals. Certainly when our brand founder was part of the company, we'd often go and have dinner with her, which was great.
Bobby Brown.
Yeah.
What's she like?
Yeah. Oh, lovely. I love her. I miss her. I love her. We're still in touch, infrequently, but enough.
Is she not at the helm of the company then anymore?
No. She hung up her reins over a year ago, which I totally understand. I mean, goodness, it was 25 years of her life devoted to this brand, and you know, she worked incredibly hard. So yeah, time for her to...
Is she retired?
No, I don't think she'll ever retire. No, she's they've just founded this stunning hotel in New Jersey called the George, which is lovely, a real mix of kind of American history and English history. She's a complete Anglophile, and yeah, she's doing some nutrition based stuff. So yeah,
have you been to the hotel?
Busy. No.
Sounds amazing. I'm going to put that on my list.
Yeah, do. And she's got like a tea room and importing real English tea. So yeah, it looks great. Google it.
Is that where they live then?
Yeah.
That sounds like a really nice, idyllic lifestyle.
Yeah, it's so cool.
Where else have you been for work then?
So for work, I'd say that's pretty much it. It's kind of all over the UK and Ireland, stateside trips, and then this wonderful trip to China. So as a child, I was lucky enough to have some really lovely European holidays with my family. And then I met my husband, who grew up in Kenya. So at 19, I had my first taste of Africa, which was wonderful, and have been back since and love it. And actually, my in-laws, they've now lived back in the UK, but for 9 years in the recent past, they lived in Marsabit, which is in the very northern tip of Kenya, right by the Ethiopian border. So I had a wonderful trip up there a couple of years back, which was interesting, you know, landing in the middle of nowhere. We tried to land. We were in a small aircraft, a light aircraft, kind of 10 people carrier. Tried to land in Mars a bit, but the weather conditions weren't good enough. So, you know, we just flew on a bit into the desert and landed in the desert. I remember getting off the plane being like, is there a loo? No, dear. You've landed in the desert.
There's the sand.
Literally. And then, you know, some Gabra tribesmen and their camels came and just sat and looked at all these white people going, what on earth is happening here?
How did you get out of the desert?
Well, news got to the landing strip in Mars a bit that the planes couldn't land. So my in-laws in their Range Rover just drove straight through the desert, and a couple of hours later found us. But yeah, it was kind of an eye-opening start to that part of the adventure. I think I hadn't prepared myself for just what life would be like living in the middle of nowhere.
Were you scared when you landed in the middle of nowhere?
Absolutely terrified. And I was terrified of the plane because I'd never been in such a tiny aeroplane. I was really unnerved by the fact that the pilot had to wear a oxygen thing and we didn't have oxygen, and when we tried to land in Marsabit we tried 3 times, so being in a tiny rickety plane coming down and then screeching back up again, genuinely there was a moment where I thought we might not make it. So yeah, I was absolutely terrified, you know, poor little London girl, absolutely terrified in the middle of nowhere. First trip to Kenya, we just drove ourselves around the country, which was again interesting because, you know, roads aren't like they are here in various places, so people drive very erratically, and when you're 18 and you're relying on your 24-year-old brother-in-law to get you about the country safely, it's quite crazy.
When you go with locals and people that live there, it's a completely different experience to anyone who's going to Kenya on a standard holiday.
Right. Well, we had the most incredible experience going for what they call Nyama Choma, which is essentially roast meat in the middle of the Mara. And we went with locals, so friends of my husband's parents and stuff. I have a picture up of it in our hallway and it's stunning. We're literally in the middle of the Masai Mara. There are just a couple of benches under trees. You've got, I think, 3 huts, a couple of pens with goats. I'm really sorry for any vegans or vegetarians listening, but you literally point to your goat. It's then slaughtered and then barbecued, and then you're brought slabs of meat on wooden trays with little piles of salt. And I remember naively being like, can we get some chips with that? And they looked at me and were like, no, Hannah, because this is it. So that was just surreal and wonderful. But then the drive back into Nairobi was terrifying because the young men who had kindly driven us have a very different attitude to road safety than we do. And they were listening to the music, drinking whiskey as they drove us into the city. And I just held onto my husband's, he was my boyfriend at the time, I held onto his hand for dear life thinking, my parents are going to be so angry if this is how I die.
You put yourself in those positions abroad. The amount of times I've been on tuk-tuks and, you know, people have been drinking, people have been doing all sorts, and, you know, it can get quite dangerous.
Yeah, we did some silly things like trekking to see some friends of theirs who are American but have looked after camel cattle for years. And we went into the desert, you know, middle of the day with no water. And, you know, whilst they were used to it and were fine, me and my sister-in-law, who's Australian, were very quickly showing some serious signs of dehydration and headaches. And it was just, yeah, it was mad. But it makes you really appreciate what you have when you're staying in someone's house, which is, you know, Rob and Sue had a house at least. But, you know, we landed, when we got there the first day, they'd lost a mum and her baby in childbirth, which was a real shocker. And they were like, sad it's really common up here because there's not a huge amount of care and support. And then they had a loo, which again, amazing, but not flushing it, not using running water, just yeah, absolutely fascinating.
What so, were they doing there, his parents?
Missionaries,
religious missionaries.
Yeah, but their main thing was famine relief. And whilst they were there, there was a huge amount of drought, and drought leads to huge tribal issues because, you know, if cattle are dying, they'll try and steal each other's camels and cows and whatever. So it was a lot of kind of trying to keep the peace up there. And yeah, famine relief.
Family of missionaries sounds incredible. What sort of upbringing did he have over there?
I think he had a really idyllic upbringing. His older brothers were of a school age. So his brother went to school out in Turi in Kenya from kind of 4 till 9. But Simon just got to stay with his parents because he was the youngest of three. And it's maddening because I feel I remember a lot of my childhood pre-5, whereas Simon feels he doesn't really remember a huge amount. But there's wonderful like cine film of him sitting under a tree at nursery school with kind of 20 or so other little kids, and he's the only white one, and he's there like singing and clapping in Swahili, and he just doesn't remember it, which is so sad. But the pictures are just wonderful. We've got them up all over the house of him just kind of barefoot in a nappy, all outside all the time, and hilarious parenting stories of, oh well, when if we had to go somewhere, we'd just leave you all in the boot of the car to sleep, and you know, that you slept in a cupboard drawer and all those kind of crazy things.
That sounds like it almost sounds like a film actually. Talking of children,
yeah,
you're on maternity leave at the moment. Yeah. You've got Bear who's 4,
five,
and Beau who's 11 weeks yeah. at this time, and luckily you live around the corner from me, so this means we're recording this in my house. If you hear any
with coffee,
children with coffee, if you hear any children crying downstairs, they're mine. They're not on their own. Do you mind talking about how we first met?
No, go ahead.
So we first met, actually online, when I'd just done the miscarriage documentary, First Heartbeat, and you contacted me to say that you'd have had a similar experience.
Yeah.
So you have this outwardly charmed life, and on, say, Instagram and YouTube, when, you know, all these people are watching you have this wonderful life and you look so glamorous and so beautiful, there is a flip side, and obviously it's not connected to that life, but there's light and shade, isn't there?
Absolutely.
What was your experience with pregnancy loss?
My husband and I married really young, and we didn't really know what our future wanted to look like. The only thing we knew is that we wanted to start a family, hence why we got married so young. So it was a real surprise when it just didn't happen for us. So eventually, after years of testings, we were advised that if we really did want children of our own, then, you know, IVF would be the route we should take. So we did go through the IVF route, the first round of which was, you know, mad. I remember being on certain jobs and having needles hidden in pairs of socks and crazy things. And at the same time, my mum was really unwell. And then we did get pregnant, which was amazing. But sadly, I lost that first baby. And that was probably, of my three miscarriages, possibly the most traumatic, because we realised that I really was miscarrying the day of my mum's funeral. So we left the internment and missed the wake to go to hospital and have a scan, and it was just horrendous. And then I couldn't not do anything. The hospital were like, we recommend 6 months rest and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't feel because there was nothing I could do to get pregnant myself. I just had to do IVF again. So they said, we'll have to self-fund this round, but we'll do it. You need to have at least three counselling sessions before we'll okay you for it. And I'm ashamed to say I just lied my way through all the counselling because I wasn't going to let anything stand in our way of trying again. And then thankfully with our second round, again, I was at Fashion Week in New York with, you know, needles and socks backstage. I remember one in particular, the stylist, Zaina Rassi, I think that's her name, had just had twins. And I remember bumping into her and having a moment of like a weird jealousy, which is ridiculous. But in that moment, I was just like, oh gosh, you're so lucky. Look at you and your twins. And I'm passing you with my needle in my socks to go and do what I had to do in the bathroom. But thankfully, Bear was born and it was great. And then, just like most people, I had the pang of wanting to give him a sibling. So we tried IVF again. And again, it was successful. I'd had a couple of bleeds early on, so I was under quite intense care and I had lots of scans. And kind of by, I think, 8 weeks, they said, no, everything's looking as it should, so this is great. It was Christmas time. I eventually got my 12-week scan actually after Christmas, so I was actually 14 and a bit weeks. And the baby had died, which was just the biggest shocker. And I was utterly convinced everything was fine, so I'd gone on my own. Bear was napping, so Si was at home with him. Yeah, just horrendous. So that really did put everything... I felt like I really regressed in terms of my grieving process, not from my first baby, but also mum and everything. And then was amazed when I had a natural pregnancy later on that year and was kind of really torn between being so thrilled because all I'd ever wanted was a natural pregnancy, but then terrified because I'd only lost, you know, just a couple of months before. And sure enough, I lost that baby too. And it felt like the sickest of jokes that, yes, we'd managed to have this pregnancy we'd longed for, but then couldn't keep it. So we actually had a break, and I just said to my husband, I can't do this anymore. And King's wanted us to go to the recurring miscarriage clinic, and I just couldn't, because by that point we'd been in and out of the unit for kind of 14, 15 months, what with treatment and everything, and this subsequent pregnancy. So we just took a break, and actually it was good for my mental health, for work, for Bear. And then, yeah, last year had a huge surprise. We were out for dinner. We were in the process of buying a house, and Bear had a night away at his grandparents, which is the first time he'd ever had that. And we were having a drink at dinner, and so I said, oh, do you want another one? I said, oh no, I feel a bit weird, maybe I'm pregnant, which I probably said in my adult lifetime about 1,000 times. But I was inquisitive enough the next day to take a test, and I did again on my own. So I went to work. I had to work from home because we were having people viewing our house, and it was positive. And just couldn't believe it, because we'd been told so many times that that wouldn't happen for us. And I thought I'd had my one chance at a natural pregnancy with my unsuccessful pregnancy before. So yeah, it was a cautious first couple of months, you know, after loss. I think you're always anticipating losing, and it's a real horrible paranoid state to be living in. But amazingly, the pregnancy was smooth, and we now have Beau.
It's incredible, isn't it, going for those scans and coming out and thinking, I can't believe it, but the baby is still there. Yeah. There's still a heartbeat. It's such a great feeling. But then as soon as you get the buzz from that feeling, you know that you've got another scan in a couple of weeks. Yeah. You know, it's just moment by moment, day by day. And actually the time moves in very mysterious ways. It drags terribly.
By the end, I was just willing this pregnancy to be over. And, you know, I even took myself up to hospital fearing I'd had reduced fetal movement. I don't know if I had, but I just suddenly panicked that I hadn't felt her.
I've done that with both of my
full-term
pregnancies. Yeah. And they prefer you to go in.
Yeah.
They do.
And that's all I will say, is that actually the NHS were fantastic and all the nurses said, no, you've done the right thing. You know, you feel embarrassed, but you wouldn't have felt embarrassed if there was something wrong. And if you come early enough, it might be that there's something we can do to help, you know, if there is something wrong with the baby.
Are you going for number three?
Do you know what? It's actually a really tricky question. Oddly now, 11 weeks, I didn't feel this way after Bear, 11 weeks postpartum, I miss being pregnant. I miss newborn babiness. So I've been, you know, to myself thinking, gosh, can't bear the thought that this is the last time we'll do this.
I know, it's awful. You get broody. When you've got a tiny baby, it almost makes you broody.
It's crazy, isn't it? But we do have the conundrum that we do have a couple of embryos still frozen. And actually, they're due, they will only keep them for 10 years. And we're kind of, I think, well, there's five. So we're 6 years into that freezing time. So we have some serious chatting to do to work out what we do with those.
Are you both on the same page with it, do you think?
It's silly to say, but I think our biggest fear is loss again.
Your experience, apart from the IVF, which I never had, I got pregnant quite easily, luckily, but then I kept losing them, so it doesn't really... I think it helps in a way, because I don't... When you struggle to get pregnant and then miscarry, you've got the double whammy. Mm. But your experience, more or less, apart from that, mirrors mine, so it must have been very strange for you when you were watching the documentary.
Well, that's the thing, and it was... I think that's why I did that insane fangirling, I'm just going to email her thing, because I couldn't believe that I was someone who was feeling the things I'd been feeling and saying them out loud, and I could watch it and feel a sense of, gosh, words are escaping me. Just so identifying with your journey, it really struck me. And I was, you know, I blubbed through your documentary, as I'm sure loads of other women who've lost did, because, again, it's so misunderstood, isn't it? And... you know, all those flippant, oh, it wasn't meant to be, and oh, I'll try again. And even with Bear, oh, well, at least you've got Bear. You know, all those throwaway comments that really diminish your pain and your struggle.
People find it very difficult to know what to say. And I don't know if there is a right thing to know what to say, apart from just, if you want to talk, I'm here. I don't really know.
Yeah.
I don't have, lots of people say, what is the right thing to say when people are going through this journey? And actually, I don't really have an answer for that.
I certainly found it helpful with the few friends who just asked how I was.
Yes, exactly.
That was really kind, because I think there was a lot of pressure to be fine. And, you know, I think after a week or two, people just assume that you're over it and you're done. And the truth is, you know, sometimes physically you're still processing the loss a week later, but certainly then, as the days go by, you're counting the rest of your pregnancy and you're comparing yourself to people you know who are pregnant around the same time, and then you grieve on your due date. And then when you see babies, toddlers, and you think, well, my child should be that age. It's a constant.
In films and TV, you get the sense that miscarriages sort of just happen and then people go to bed for a few days and then it's sort of over with. But actually, for some people, it never leaves you. And like you said, it's the anniversaries, it's the date, it's the birth, it's other people having babies around the same time. And physically, it takes a long time to leave your system. The hormones, not just the emotions, the actual hormones. You know, getting over a pregnancy.
I think with my missed miscarriage, mentally, by the time I actually had surgery that time, but by the time I got to that point, my body thought it had been pregnant for 15 weeks and it had 8 months of treatment to get me to that place. And my body was, my hormones were all over the place. And you don't recover from that.
No, suddenly to not be pregnant is the weirdest thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I always used to go out and just drink. That was my, I'm just going to go and have some wine.
Why not?
So I better get back to travel, even though I could speak about this for ages. Oh, very quickly, makeup is a very interesting thing, isn't it? Because this research has shown that wearing the right makeup, maybe, makes people more likely to be hired for a job, for all sorts of things. So it's not just about... it's not just about the sort of shallow, looking pretty, sort of frivolous side of it, is it, with makeup?
No, not at all. And actually, I credit Sally Hughes with a nugget of wisdom that she once imparted to me that I repeat time and time again. And she said, if I can be an advocate of a woman spending 5 minutes a day doing something that is purely for her, that is a moment of self-loving, as it were, then great. And actually, I'm a huge believer in that. And whether... you're a celebrity, you've got to face a red carpet, or you're Jane from down the road who's just feeling miserable about herself, you can both benefit from a bit of makeup, a time interaction with someone, or if you're doing it with yourself, it's alone time, and just feeling that little bit more confident. And I'm feeling that now with this postpartum phase more than ever, actually, because I didn't bother with Bear, and I was very low after I had Bear, and it was winter, and I was cold, and I was miserable. Whereas with Beau, I was really hopeful that I wouldn't feel the same way. And actually, when I'm exhausted, if I just spend 5 minutes putting on a tiny bit of makeup, I feel that I physically don't embody how I'm feeling. I'm able to present myself in a different way. Whereas the days when I don't bother, I feel like my language, my tone of voice, my body language, I kind of emulate how I look. It's as weird as that sounds. So for me, in this time, makeup is the most incredible empowering tool to help me feel a bit better.
It's almost like a whole smile, fake it till you make it.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm a huge believer in that, actually.
The Royal Wedding, did you actually do Kate Middleton's makeup? Because I've been researching this a little bit online and it's a bit ambiguous. Did you do her makeup?
And I think it shall always remain ambiguous.
Last week I was interviewing someone who had signed the Official Secrets Act. So have you done something like that with the royal family that you can't actually tell us whether you did the royal makeup
various,
or not?
For various clients, I have signed non-disclosure agreements. So, yeah, there are many things that I'd love to discuss, but I shan't.
You have said publicly that you advised the Duchess of Cambridge on her wedding makeup, but I don't know whether you said you actually went to the palace and did it.
I certainly love helping brides feel good about themselves on their wedding day. Like, it's the one day in your life that everyone wants to know what you look like. It's not like when you bump into a friend for coffee or whatever that they're like, great, I can't wait to see what she looks like today. But on a wedding day, you really do. There's so much pressure on the hair, the dress, the whatever. So I definitely love all my work with brides.
So you haven't got the call with Meghan then?
I cannot wait to see what she looks like on her wedding day. She is going to be just a stunning bride.
She's so beautiful, isn't she?
I'm so intrigued to know what style she's going to go for.
Something classic, but fabulous.
I imagine.
My 5-year-old, Sebastian, you know, they love you so much and they can't see your imperfections at this age. Whenever he sees her on the paper, he goes, is that you, mummy? I'm like,
oh,
yeah, that's me.
I love that. Now you say it.
Yeah, right.
You do have, well, with your olive skin and your dark features. Yeah. You should own that, Lisa.
Oh, yeah, I will. I'll start doing lookalike parties. So back to travel. Where else have you been? Am I missing any travel stories?
Then they say you've been to Africa once. You either hate it or you get it under your skin. I absolutely love it and look forward to our trips with the children in the future. As a child, I've always said that I'm, you know, born on the wrong continent. I'm not a cold weather person. I'm a sun loving person. The beach is absolutely my happy place. So for our honeymoon, we went to the Maldives for just 2 weeks of nothing, which was idyllic. And then actually, after my mum died in the miscarriage, we went on what we call a sod it holiday, and we went back to the Maldives just to have again a couple of weeks of, you know, my paradise on earth. Just, you know, supplement the vitamin D and just have some rest and recuperation in surroundings that to me are pretty much perfect. For some people that might be the mountains, for other people it might be a really funky city break, but for me, give me white sand, clear blue waters and sunshine and I'm happy. That's my happy place.
It makes me almost physically crave that at the moment with the bad weather and also having two kids. You know, I can't remember, I've been to the Maldives and many places like that, and I can't remember the last time I got to relax on a beach. Yeah. Obviously, I wouldn't trade it for the world, but yeah, life changes and travels change.
It's so different, isn't it? Yeah.
Have you taken the kids anywhere exciting? Not Beau, obviously.
We've taken Bear to Spanish islands, so we've been to Menorca the once with him and then Mallorca a couple of times, and it just works. It's not too far away, weather's great. We've always rented villas and just had a really lovely low-key self-catering holidays, and he's absolutely loved them. And, you know, yeah, my husband's done Ironman and stuff while we've been there, which hasn't been ideal, but if I can get a couple of days of sun and family time before races, then that's a bonus.
Have you got any plans to take the two of them away now you're a mother of two?
Well, Simon is considering doing Ironman Lanzarote in October, I think. So, yeah, I think that will be our first holiday abroad with the babes.
It's a really good time to go to Lanzarote, actually.
Is it?
Yes, in October. I've been in October, and it's great for kids.
Good. Oh, I'm so pleased.
Holidays change when you have children. You know, the Maldives days are probably a little bit further off in the future, yeah, as they are in your past right now. But hopefully they're in your future as well.
Oh, fingers crossed, when they get a bit bigger. Gosh, Bear would go stir crazy, that's for sure.
You need to entertain them, don't you? Yeah. I have my last question for you.
Yeah.
It's probably going to throw you because it throws everyone. To me, music goes hand in hand with travelling a lot of the time. People do take time to listen to music like they don't necessarily do at home because you have more time. If you had to pinpoint a song that you've listened to, that you've had a musical moment that reminds you of your travels, be it China, New York, Kenya, Mallorca, Menorca, wherever, what would that song be and what is that memory?
I suppose there are different ones for different places, but, and this is so cheesy, but it means a great deal to me. You know, the classic New York, New York. So my dad used to do a lot of work in the States when he was like a young lawyer, and we used to go out and visit him. And one time my mum went and stayed with him in New York for a bit, and we stayed with friends and family for a week or two. And she just came back saying that New York was the most exciting city she'd ever visited. And I was probably 7 at the time, but I remember thinking, oh, I just want to go to New York. And it just never really happened in my young adult life. So when I first got into a role at Bobbi Brown where I was going to have to go to New York, it actually wasn't for Fashion Week, it was for what we call boot camp, so like a training for all the pro artists. It was such a massive moment because, you know, not only was I visiting this place that my mum had always said was the most exciting place she'd ever been, I was then getting to go, but I was going in a professional capacity as a makeup artist. You know, I felt like I'd really made it in my career. I was young at the time, but it, for me, it was such a massive benchmark. And then to be in New York with my global colleagues from the company was such a, oh my goodness, pinch me now moment. And before I went, yeah, I just listened to that song, all these fun New York songs, which really, really resonate with me because there is so much, you know, associated with my time there, whether it's shooting Bobby's Pretty Powerful book back in 2011, which mum was really ill. It'd been a big year work-wise, and she asked me to come and shoot her book, and I was featured in the book as well as doing makeup for the book. You know, I was featured in trailers for her book. I was on NBC channel sometimes. My face was on a bus in Hong Kong. All these crazy things because of that trip to the States. And then, of course, Fashion Week being such a massive career-defining time. You know, I was lucky enough to go back out to shoot Bobby's latest book before she left the company, and I got to go and stay at her house for a couple of days, and just I have really special, really fond memories of New York. I love it.
Thank you so much, Hannah, and thanks to all our family members for keeping the kids quiet whilst we recorded this at home. Don't forget to drop us a line if you have any suggestions for guests, questions, you name it. I'm interested to hear from you. See you next time on the Big Travel Podcast.